Well, this morning we're continuing our summer series in Ecclesiastes, one more to go, and then we'll be done with Ecclesiastes. And this morning we find ourselves in the 11th chapter, and we're going to be reading and reflecting on verses 1 to 6. If you need it, you can find the reading on page 559 of the Pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 11, beginning in verse 1. Let us now give our attention to God's good and gracious word. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way the spirit or soul comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. This is the word of the Lord. In 1990, a group known as the American Dialect Society came up with the idea of selecting a word of the year. And this particular word had to be one that was used not only a lot of times in that particular year, but it had to in some way define that year. So for example, in 1993, the year I graduated, showing my age, the word of the year was information superhighway. We don't hear that very much anymore. Why? Because information superhighway was the precursor to what we know now as the modern internet. But in 1993, we were still a little behind. In 1999, when the year Niecy and I were married, the word was Y2K. And it spoke to the global anxiety that surrounded a majority of people with the turning of the century. In 2001, what do you think it was? Come on, 9/11. 2020, COVID, you got it. And last year, it was slop. And it's not referring to pig food. No, slop refers to the high quantity yet low quality content that's put out by AI. Now, I mention all this because here's what I would like to put forward this morning. And that is the idea of having a word of history, or to use the language of Ecclesiastes, a word that best defines what it's like to live under the sun. That is to live life as it currently is and has been ever since the fall of humanity. And here's the word I have in mind: uncertainty. Life under the sun is full of uncertainty. And we hear it all the time, how there's economic and global uncertainty, how there's political uncertainty, especially in an election season, how there's uncertainty when it comes to institutions, including the church. And with the rise of AI and all the unknowns it looks to bring, there's technological uncertainty. And with all this, there's our own personal uncertainty. Uncertainty regarding our health, our marriages, whether or not we'll ever get married, uncertainty with regard to our children, no matter their age. We all experience a measure of uncertainty. And here's the reason. None of us knows what tomorrow will bring. None of us knows what tomorrow will bring. And it's our lack of knowledge that the writer of Ecclesiastes, who I've been calling the convener, wants to stress. Now, you may recall back at the beginning of chapter 9, he already told us that we don't know if our lives will be filled with love or filled with hate. We want love, but many times we get hate. We don't know. Then in the middle of chapter 9, he told us that we don't know our time. At any moment, like a bird, we could be snared and caught by death. And now here in this passage, he uses the phrase, "you don't know," four times in just these six verses. He says in verse 2, "You don't know what disaster may happen on earth. We may know that dark clouds, will bring rain. But those same clouds could produce a devastating tornado. We don't know. Living under the sun in a fallen and fickle world means disaster could strike at any moment. When I was in eighth grade, an uncle of mine was killed in a plane crash over at DFW. Went on a work trip, never came home. When Nisi and I were newly married, some of our family friends lost their 12-year-old son to an aneurysm, while another son was permanently paralyzed on the last play of the last practice of his senior year. We don't know when or how a disaster may come into our lives, either personally or globally. We're told also in verse 6 that we don't know if we'll experience success or failure. None of us sets out to fail, do we? When you ask a little child, what do you want to be when you grow up? I've never heard a child say, I want to be a loser. No, we all want to experience a measure of success, but it could be that no matter how hard we plan, prioritize, or even pray, failure and disaster has a way of slapping us in the face. And then in verse 5, we're told that we don't know the work of God who makes everything. As creatures, we can't understand God's works, and we certainly can't accomplish His works. Yes, we can experience and see the wind, but we don't know where the wind's going or why it goes there. And in an even more profound way, we don't know how God knits together an embodied soul in the womb. It's a mystery. God and His works are ultimately beyond our comprehension, which means it's impossible for us to ever get to the point where we know God fully. If we could know God fully, He wouldn't be God. But even though we'll never know God fully, we can know Him truly. Why? Well, because in His grace, He's made Himself known. And He's done so in creation, in providence, and most clearly, He's made Himself known in the person and work of Christ, who Himself, think about this, here's the reason Christ is the clearest revelation of God, because Jesus is the only human who fulfills the job description of being God. And He does so for us. He's God in the flesh, revealing God to us for our redemption. Friends, before God and His works, the only proper response is that of the Apostle Paul, who declares at the end of Romans 11, "Oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments. How inscrutable His ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been His counselor?" Answer, no one. When it comes to life, you and I are merely managers. But God is the maker. He's the director. And He's the sustainer. As George W. Bush would put it, God is the ultimate decider. We may be able to predict the weather to some extent. We usually get it right here in Texas in August, hot and dry. But it's God who causes the weather. He controls the wind. His sovereignty extends to whether a tree falls in the north or the south. We don't know. What we don't know, He knows. What we can't control, He oversees and somehow orchestrates for the accomplishment of His good purpose. In this life, under the sun, uncertainty abounds. But what's uncertain to us is absolutely certain to God. And that's why we can trust Him. But before we get to that, let me point out some wrong reactions to uncertainty. And there's two of them, I think, here from this passage. Two wrong reactions to the reality of uncertainty. Here's the first: paralysis. This comes out in verse 4, where it says, "He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap." Here's the person who refuses to do anything until they can be sure that all the conditions are right. Until life is risk-free, they refuse to act. But don't you see the problem? Life under the sun is and never will be risk-free. The conditions will never be perfect. Storms are always on the horizon. Problems remain under the surface. You never know when a tree, an obstacle, might fall in your path. There's so much we can't predict or even explain in this world. And if we wait until we can, we'll be stuck. We'll waste away in a state of indecisiveness. We'll be like that sluggard in Proverbs 26:13 who refused to leave his house because there might be a lion in the road. Now, there's nothing wrong with planning. It's wise to do so. But if you're planning, okay, if your planning is nothing more than trying to ensure that all your choices will work out and that your life will be smooth sailing, you'll never actually get in the boat of life. Even more, you'll never grow up. You'll stay stuck in a state of paralysis, paralyzed because you're consumed with self-protection. What's the other reaction to uncertainty? Well, it's hoarding. It's getting as much as you can while you can. Because here's the thinking. If disaster could strike tomorrow, then I might as well get as much as I can today. Because life is uncertain, what I need to do is make sure that I have everything that I need. In particular, that I have the money and the possessions I need to survive and thrive when disaster strikes. What's the problem? Well, hoarding might get you through some disasters, but it won't get you through the great disaster of death and God's coming judgment. So here's the wisdom. If hoarding can't save you ultimately, then why practice it presently? Another problem with hoarding is this, that the more things we have, the more those things tend to have us. The more we have, those things tend to have more of us. Our stockpile of stuff has a way of ruling us. And the more it rules us, the more afraid we become. Afraid either of losing what we have or never having enough. Friends, there's no way around it. Hoarding either out of pleasure or out of fear is idolatry. It's centering your life on created things, things that won't last. It's looking to fading treasures for your ultimate security and even your identity. Treasures that could go up in smoke just like that. And when they do, the person who's put their hope and trust in their possessions, in their hoarding, finds themselves devastated. They're thrust into despair. In writing about this, Tim Keller, in his book Counterfeit Gods, recounts some of the sad tales of what happened in the wake of the 2008 global economic crisis. He writes, after the crisis began, there followed a tragic string of suicides of formerly wealthy and well-connected individuals. The acting financial officer of Freddie Mac hanged himself in his basement. The chief executive of a leading real estate auction firm shot himself in the head behind the wheel of his red Jaguar. A French money manager who invested the wealth of many of Europe's royal and leading families and who had lost $1.4 billion of his clients' money in a Ponzi scheme slit his wrist and died in his Madison Avenue office. These poor people built their life on sand. They'd laid up treasures on earth, and when disaster struck, when their supposed identity and security were ripped away, they despaired of life itself. So the wrong reactions to uncertainty are paralysis and hoarding, both of which, by the way, are forms of self-salvation, trying to save and protect ourselves from the unknown. So what's the right reaction? What's the wise reaction to living amidst uncertainty? It's radical giving. That is radically giving yourself to Christ in faith and generously or radically giving yourself to and for others. That's the main point of verses 1 to 2 where it says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight. Cast and give. Cast your bread upon the waters. And please don't get the image that here the convener's calling us to go out and feed some ducks. No, what he's calling us to is in the midst of the chaotic waters of uncertainty, which is where we live, what he's calling us to do is boldly cast ourselves on the surety of God, the one who makes everything, who's at work in everything, and who will redeem everything for his glory and the ultimate good of his people, which is the ultimate good of us knowing him as our all in all. You see, when it says cast your bread, remember this is Proverbs. Because they're Proverbs, we're not to read them literally. So bread doesn't mean literal bread. Rather, it's being used symbolically. Bread is symbolic of life, our lives. Amidst the waters of uncertainty, cast your life on God, trusting that when you do, he'll give your life back to you. Now, friends, this is the very thing that Jesus tells us in the Gospels. When he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. He'll find it. You hear the connection? Cast your life on me, trusting that even though it'll feel like a loss, it's hard, it's difficult, what it actually is great gain. Or we could put it like this: cast your bread, your life, on Christ, because he's the bread of life, the one who gives the fullness of life to us who are empty and enslaved in death. Here's how C.S. Lewis sums it up in Mere Christianity. He writes, when Christ comes to you, he says, give me your all. I don't want so much of your time and so much of your money and so much of your work. No, I want you. I haven't come to torment your natural self. I've come to kill it. No half measures will do. Hand over your whole natural self, all the desires which you think innocent as well as the ones you think wicked. I want the whole outfit. And I will give you a new self. Instead, in fact, says Lewis, I will give you myself. My own will become yours. The call of the gospel is to act boldly amidst uncertainty, boldly casting ourselves on Christ, who himself promises to give us his new and solid life. A life that is able to endure the coming disasters and even death that will ultimately touch us. Have you? Are you casting your whole self on Christ? And if not, what's holding you back? What are those areas in your life where you're like, okay, I want Jesus to have this, but I got to have my precious. No, just like Gollum's precious destroyed him, that little precious will destroy you. Give it over to Christ. Cast it on Christ, who promises that in his way and in his time, he'll give you a new self. And ultimately, it'll be the self of being resurrected to live in his new creation that'll be filled with the glory of God. Radically cast yourself on Christ. But with this, we're also to radically begin to give ourselves away for the sake of others. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8. Give in the nth degree. Or as Jesus tells us in Luke 6, give to everyone who begs from you. And from one who takes away your goods, don't demand them back. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Radical giving is to characterize the Christian life. Does it characterize your life? Well, it won't unless your heart has been captured by God's first and supreme giving. God is never passive, and God never hoards. Why would he have to hoard? He already owns it all. It's his. No, God is an active giver, And it's his radical giving, his revolutionary generosity that alone empowers us, enables us to radically give, to cast ourselves generously on Christ, and to begin to give ourselves away in generosity for others. And we think, well, where do we see God's generosity? Well, the first place we see it is in his creation. In the beginning, when he created all things. When God made the world, he wasn't stingy. He was liberal. He filled the seas with swarming creatures. He loaded up the skies with flying creatures. He populated the land with all kinds of walking and creeping creatures. And when he made humans, he said to them, "It's all for you. It's yours." Out of his generosity, God made all things. And out of that same abundant generosity, he personally knit you in your mother's womb. God didn't create because he was in need, because he lacked. No, God by nature is infinitely full. And it was out of the abundance of his fullness that he chose to create, which means everything. Everything is sheer gift. We go further, even philosophically, and say, everything that is absolutely unnecessary. God alone is the necessary being. We aren't necessary, and yet here we are. Why? Because God is generous in his love. He is generous to share himself with those whom he makes. In pondering this, the generous abundance of creation, listen to what Eugene Peterson says. I love this quote. He says, "It doesn't take long to realize that we're set down in a world prodigious in wealth. The Creator is incredibly generous. We're given what we need, but also much, much more. We're given not just a few trees to shade us from the sun, but entire forests of pine and beech and oak. We're not just given a few stars so that we can locate north and navigate our ships, but skies full of gleaming pictures and stories. We're given not just a few birds to keep the insects under control, but a huge ballet company of shapes, colors, and songs as they pirouette and cut arcs through the air for our endless delight. In his generosity, God made you to fill you with the abundance of himself." Now here's some homework. Sometime this week, stop and intentionally ponder this creation. Let yourself wonder at it. Then ponder your place within this creation. And then I want you to ask yourself this question. What do I have that I didn't ultimately receive from my generous God? And then give thanks. Give abundant, generous thanks to the God who's given us everything. So we see God in his creation, see his generosity in creation, but even more amazingly, we see it in his redemption. We rebelled against our generous maker. Stupid. We rebelled against our generous maker. We fell for the lie that he was stingy, that he was holding back from us. And so what did we do? Well, we went after the one thing, the only thing God said was off limits. And as a result of our rebellion, we were exiled from that abundant, lush garden into a land of scarcity and uncertainty. Yet in the face of our rebellion, God, out of his generosity, promised to come after us. We went into hiding, running away. God promised to come after us, and he kept his promise ultimately in Jesus. Out of his generosity, the Father has given his very best. He's given us his own heart in giving us his Son. And the Son, out of his generosity, came. He took on our humanity that he might offer his life for our life on the cross. So that through his generous and sacrificial death, we might be generously forgiven, generously reconciled to God, and generously ensured of a solid future where we will find our lives resurrected and full of the life of God. The abundant son became a slave, condemned to die, in order to free us, empty slaves of sin and death. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, says Paul, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich, rich with his own life. In radical generosity, Jesus cast his whole self on the cross. And after he was raised from the dead and took his rightful place as the Lord of the cosmos, what did he do? He generously poured out his Spirit so that through the Spirit, he and his Father might dwell in us as our all in all, that we might know God as our ultimate security amidst our uncertainty. God loves a cheerful giver because he himself is the great cheerful giver. And friends, it's only when this grips our hearts, when it actually sort of grabs us at the core of our being, that we'll be freed up. We'll be freed from the paralysis and hoarding and self-protection to become a generous and self-giving people. That's why on a daily basis, we need to remind ourselves and be amazed by the reality of God's generosity. It's generosity that enables us to make Christ our greatest treasure. Because you see, it's only when Christ is our greatest treasure that we'll begin to see our time and possessions, money and talents for what they are: expendable. Where these things used to be seen as the source of our happiness, the Christian now sees Christ alone as the source of his or her joy, security, satisfaction, and peace. To quote Keller again, he once said this: if the God of the universe was voluntarily torn to shreds on the cross for all your debts, how can your attitude to your possessions and self-protection not be changed forever? So that in being changed, we might begin to live for him in the morning and in the evening, whether the time seems right or the weather seems right, in times of plenty or in times of poverty. Well, let me end with what I'm calling here a helpful word, which I see as the New Testament counterpart or fulfillment of the word we're given here in Ecclesiastes. And here I'm thinking of Paul's words in 1 Timothy 6 and verses 17 to 19. I encourage you to ponder these words, meditate upon them, let them speak to your heart. Paul writes and says, "As for the rich in this present age," and friends, as Americans living in this country, we are rich. In comparison, we are rich. "As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, because everything they have and everything they are is a gift from God, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life." By God's generous grace, may these words grip our hearts both individually and corporately, so that in this world of uncertainty, the surety of God's magnanimous generosity may be on display in us as people. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.